Hey, say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett, and the website once again, strangeplanet.ca, strangeplanet.ca. Aaron Murakami is standing by to challenge the orthodox understanding of the laws of thermodynamics. He wants to share his plasma ignition system with the world. The question is, will he be able to circumvent the protectors of the status quo? We'll find out when Coast continues right after this. Aaron Murakami is an internationally sought-after author, researcher, and inventor. He's committed to the development and distribution of information and technologies that have been suppressed from the general public. Aaron has open-sourced many gigabytes of his work in energetic forum for many years. That includes his work on the plasma ignition, the gray tube, the water fuel cell technology, the Ainsley inductive resistor circuits, and others. He's also a founder of Energetic Forum and Energy Science Forum, which is a combined membership of over 100,000, and is the primary organizer for the Energy Science and Technology Conference. Aaron is committed to the development and distribution of highly disruptive information. He's a former health food store owner and has spearheaded many ventures. He's a consultant to several technology groups. His books include The Quantum Key and A Course in Mind Power. His invention of the world's most efficient plasma ignition system that actually burns water in an engine has been awarded a U.S. patent. His other works include How to Build a Jet Engine, Ignition Secrets, and Water Fuel Secrets. Aaron Murakami, welcome to Coast AM. How are you?
Thank you very well, Richard. It's an honor to be on Coast to Coast.
First of all, I have to ask you about Spokane. My first visit to your fine city a couple of months ago, and less than that, you have these incredible whitewater rapids running right through town. But what is it about Spokane? Because as I discovered, and one of the reasons I went there, not only to visit you, but other people, Paul Babcock and others, there are so many inventors there in Spokane working on advanced energy devices. What is it about Spokane?
I'm not really sure, but it is like one of these little vortex cities. It's a kind of a small city, but a lot of big things happen here. Here in about 7 hours, the world's largest timed road race is going to start off, known as Bloomsday. A lot of people don't know a lot about Spokane, but for some reason, this area attracts a lot of innovative researchers and developers and in all kinds of different technologies, and a lot of them stay pretty low profile, so you'd never know who they are. But a lot of the people who are considered to be some of the pioneers in the modern-day Tesla science, so-called free energy technologies, just happen to be swarming all around the Inland Northwest area.
Now, how does a young, if I can use this term, a young Army brat who grew up in military bases in the United States and also in Japan, because you're of Japanese descent, how did you become an inventor and what some might call a disruptive thinker?
Actually, it's an Air Force brat, kind of close. But growing up, always have been fairly mechanically inclined. My father was a mechanic before he joined the Air Force, and my mom's dad, he was also a mechanic and always tinkering on things. And, you know, even my mom worked on her own car when she was younger and kind of souped it up, had an old Camaro. And little by little, after I got out of high school and, you know, didn't really know kind of what I wanted to do with my life, I wanted to become a software engineer and went to school for a little bit at Wright State University when my dad was stationed at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and then kind of dropped out. And little by little, I kind of became unhappy with how the world operates, you know, the so-called system. And because of some of the experiences that, you know, myself and my family went through when my dad was retiring from the Air Force, which was not, you know, too much of a happy situation, I kind of got into a little rebellious mode. But and left Spokane, went back and forth to Japan quite a few times, and back around June of 95, I decided to plant my feet in Spokane and started to research energy technologies and consciousness technologies, and the internet was kind of new, and I didn't really know what direction to go, and kind of dropped it all because I didn't really know what I was looking at online. And little by little, through all these crazy synchronicities, one person right after another would introduce me to somebody who was considered, you know, the top in the world in their own field, and little by little learning from them and kind of seeing what the principles are that their technologies operate under, it kind of got the wheels kind of clicking. And little by little, I started to apply those parameters through how I'd looked at different technologies to see, how I could, make them better or bring them closer to what, some people would call, free energy technologies.
I remember you telling me when we were visiting that you would be on a website over in Japan, I think it was, and you'd be checking out these so-called free energy sites and learning about them. And then only to arrive in Spokane many years later, and you would find out that the individual that was responsible for putting that website together was right there in the Spokane area.
Yeah, actually I was in Spokane, and I was staying at my parents' house at the time, and I was looking online for energy and, perpetual motion, and, at that time I didn't know a resistor from a transistor, and just searching online for energy technologies, and a lot of it I could see was junk. But there was one website I kept going to over and over and over that kind of intrigued me, and I saw these little diagrams of little motors and generators and some little magnetic type setups, and I didn't really know enough to understand what it was, but there was just something about it that kept drawing me back to it. Well, after I kind of dropped everything and several years later, it was maybe 3 or 4 years later, one of my friends, Roger Estes, who is the first and only non-Chinese person in the world to be certified as a natural-born Qigong master by the Chinese Qigong delegation. At that time, most of my time was spent with natural healing and consciousness development and that kind of thing. And we were looking at developing some LED healing devices. This is almost 20 years ago, before a lot of companies, got into that field. I worked with some of the people who actually pioneered a lot of that. And they met somebody through a mutual attorney that was working with an electronics company. And when Roger gets back, he tells me he met with somebody that had this little motor in a case that when it started running, it kept itself charged up. Instantly, that kind of blew my mind, and I just had to meet this person. And so the next day, Roger drove me out there, and I met somebody named John Bedini. And this was around 1999. And I saw a demonstration of that motor. He just turned it, and it started picking up its own speed. The funny thing about it was that it had dead batteries in it. But it sped up, and it actually charged those batteries up, turned a propeller, was blinking lights, and it was producing mechanical work. And I said, well, how can I find out about this? And he asked if I was on the internet, and I said I was, and he gave me a website. And so as soon as I got back home, I looked up that website, and it was the website that I kept going to over and over and over several years before. And out of anywhere in the world, he just happens to live about 45 minutes from my house.
There you go. That's what I'm talking about. There's something magical about Spokane. You use the term vortex. I'm wondering if it has anything to do with all the the underground water systems that run through Spokane.
Yeah, I've never thought about that too much, but we do have what's considered to be probably one of the top aquifers on the planet, which was created during the Great Missoula Flood about, 9 to 12,000 years ago. And but there's, this is a very interesting place. For a long time, I kept getting out of this place because I couldn't stand it. I didn't really know anybody. I figured, maybe someday I'll come back to Spokane, maybe when I'm retired. And so when I planted my feet in June of 95, kind of went on a little, kind of went on my soul-searching mission, I guess you could say. And I kind of dropped everything for a couple years. And then little by little, turns out that everything I've ever been looking for was right here in my own backyard.
And now others are coming there to be around people like yourself and yes. Bedini and Paul Babcock and others, and so it's just sort of multiplying. Before I get you to describe the plasma ignition system, I want to point out that our webmaster, Sean Latisore, has posted some videos in the carousel at coasttocoastam.com. Just go to the homepage, and people can see your demonstration of your device I guess there's three separate videos, but about six different demonstrations. Again, you just go to the homepage, coasttocoastam.com, and you find the slide that says Murakami Plasma Videos. And there they can find three videos and about six demonstrations in all. Maybe they can watch them during the break or after the program and get a real sense of what we're talking about. Now, explain in really simple language, Aaron, not for the Coast listeners, but for the host who struggled with grade 9 physics and grade 11 chemistry.
Okay.
Explain what a plasma ignition system is. Let's start with what it looks like.
Okay. If if you're familiar with what a regular spark looks like at a spark plug, kind of looks like a little high voltage streamer, which is this little illuminated light stream, like a piece of hair that goes between two points on a spark plug. And when that's in the engine and you have the air fuel mixture, as soon as it sparks, that spark is what ignites the fuel mixture to create an explosion to push the piston down. To enhance the ignition systems, there's all kinds of performance ignition systems that increase the strength of that spark to make it a little bit more impressive, but it's still just a regular conventional spark. It's just a little bit beefier. The most common type of performance ignition system would probably be a capacitive discharge ignition, which means you're putting stronger power into an ignition coil than just attaching a battery to it, you know, through the timing system. And it gives a bit of a beefier spark.
What's the advantage of having a beefier spark?
You can burn more fuel, more of the same fuel that's in there, which means you're going to get an increase in mileage, increase in power, and a decrease in emissions. At least that's the goal. With people who are putting them in their cars for racing, they don't really care about the emissions or the mileage. They just want more power.
In other words, with a bigger spark, you're burning more of the fuel, and so there's no waste. Because a lot of the fuel, I don't know what percentage is. I was shocked when I heard it, but it's very high. The actually, you know, sort of drizzles out the tailpipe in liquid form. I mean, there's a lot of waste.
Yeah, most of it is wasted. I mean, the average car on the road today is in the low 20% efficiency, which means 80% is chewed up in wasted heat in the engine because of the low thermal efficiency and emissions. And it's a, you know, it's a shame. And so with the plasma ignition, there's many things that's quite profound about it. And one of them is that it's not just a bigger spark, it's a completely different phenomenon. But for the exact same amount of potential energy in a capacitor that would be in a typical performance ignition system, I can take the exact same capacitor with the exact same joules of potential energy there, and I can cause it to discharge in a short period of time that's way shorter than is normally thought possible, and it cranks the power through the roof, and it creates like a ball of sunshine at the spark plug.
I saw the spark, and people can see it if they go on the video as well, the Murakami Plasma videos at coasttocoastam.com. It's an intense ball of white light, nothing like you would see coming off of a normal a spark plug. And but what's more is that you spray vaporized, you spray a water vapor onto it, and it intensifies.
Yeah, it gets bigger.
That spark. So what's happening there?
Okay, so with a regular spark, that's just kind of igniting the fuel. With the plasma ignition, it is igniting the fuel, but what happens is because I can create such a high power effect from the same joules of potential energy, what happens is it creates a strong disruptive discharge, actually in a little bit more of an advanced way than what Tesla was even doing. With this particular method. And what happens is it creates a strong positive and negative at that gap, so strong and so fast that it instantly dissociates and pulls the hydrogen from water right out of the moisture in the air. It grabs some of the hydrogen and it rips it right off of some of the hydrocarbon fuels just right on contact. And what happens is that in turn, it instantly ignites that hydrogen, and that hydrogen is what in turn ignites the rest of the fuel.
And now, normally this is achieved through electrolysis, where you put like a bubbler inside distilled water, ideally, and you've got some sort of a, like a silver plate in there, and it separates the hydrogen molecules from the oxygen molecules, right?
Correct, and
now,
that would be...
You're not using electrolysis here, though. It's happening like instantaneously.
Yeah, it happens so fast, it's almost impossible to catch on a camera. Is how fast it is. Yeah, typical electrolysis, you're basically running electrical current through water at whatever conductivity it happens to be. And as that current is moving through, it's going to pull the hydrogen over to the negative plate, oxygen over to one plate. And a lot of people are doing this in electrolyzers, and they may refer to them as so-called HHO boosters that they're adding on to cars to supplement their air fill mixture to get these kind of effects. But with the plasma ignition, whether it's just the moisture in the ambient air or it's you're adding, you know, water vapor or the HHO, the speed of this impulse is so fast and so ferocious, it will instantly just rip it apart, ignite it right on contact, and that in turn ignites the fuel.
Now, you're not actually then running the engine. You wouldn't be running the engine on water, would you?
Well, see, there's two different directions you can go with this water fuel. The way most people are doing it is they're using little electrolysis cells to create a little bit of water gas through electrolysis. The old school method, you know, like in the high school experiment, would be to separate the hydrogen and oxygen, and they keep those gases separate, and then if they are going to be reburned, then they're re-added together in different proportions to be reburned. But in most of the cells people are doing, it's known as a commonly ducted cell, and what that means is you keep all the hydrogen and the oxygen products from the electrolysis all together in one area. That gets ducted into the engine to be mixed with the air-fuel mixture in there as a supplement. And the other category is where people are looking to use 100% water, where it's not, where the water fuel is not a supplement, but that is the whole fuel. But one clarification I would like to make is that a lot of people using these so-called HHO boosters are not really understanding where the gains are coming from. The hydrogen from those little water cells, when it's used as a supplement, is not even an energy source. What it is it's an igniter. It's a two-step ignition process. When somebody electrolyzes some of this water gas and they duct that to their intake to mix with their air-fuel ratio, what happens is even their normal, typical, little, weak spark can ignite that hydrogen from that water fuel. And what that hydrogen does is it has such a hot, fast flame speed that it detonates and penetrates the combustion chamber and ignites the rest of the fuel more effectively. And
in other words, you're not burning hydrogen as fuel. It's simply an incendiary device to make sure that the gasoline, the vapors, is all ignited efficiently. So you're getting, you know, more miles per gallon. You're using
exactly
more of the fuel. So then what was Stanley Meyer and his famous dune buggy that we saw all over YouTube about,
right,
running this dune buggy across North America on a cup full of water or whatever? I mean, a little bit of hyperbole there, but I mean, was that a hoax?
I don't believe it was. I wasn't there to witness it myself, but I have quite a few friends who I believe are very credible that were there to witness it, and also some friends who have replicated that type of technology in different applications who also knew Meyer, Stan Meyer, back in the 90s, early 90s. And what he was doing, there's more misinformation on Stan Meyer on the internet than probably any other type of so-called free energy technology. A lot of people are looking at magical ways to create all this crazy amounts of water gas through pulsed electrolysis circuits, but that's in fact not the primary key to what Meyer was doing.
All right, let me take a time out here, Aaron. We'll pick this up on the other side, Stanley Meyer. But we'll also continue to delve into the plasma ignition system. The inventor, Aaron Murakami, joins us right here on Coast to Coast AM. Stay with us. We will get back to our conversation with inventor Aaron Murakami in just a moment, and we'll have to ask him, is it time to repeal the second law of thermodynamics? Back with more right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. Aaron Murakami is with us, inventor of the plasma ignition system. Before the break, Aaron, we were talking about the late Stanley Meyer and his water engine, and you said that it wasn't a hoax, but people were not understanding correctly what he was doing. He wasn't running his engine on water per se. So what was going on there?
Yeah, he was basically creating a synthetic water fuel, which is basically an ammonia-based fuel based on nitrogen. And so in his early work, in his later work, he always mentions that to slow down and control the rate of the water gas burn, you have to add non-combustible gas to it. And it's always been debatable what that was. But if you look at his earliest work, he completely spells it out that nitrogen is what's necessary to control the burn rate of the hydrogen. Because as anybody knows that has experimented with some of the electrolyzed water gas, if you ignite it, it has a quick, fast pop. It detonates. And when you have a fuel that detonates, it's not suitable for an engine. It's going to hit the piston. The piston is going to hit that connecting rod, which is going to bang against the crankshaft, and it's just not made for that kind of engine. So he wasn't looking for a detonating type of gas, which is exactly what you're going to get if all you're after is electrolyzing a lot of water gas. So what he was doing was basically utilizing nitrogen in a process where that was mixing with the water fuel to slow down the burn. See, when people are looking at water coming out of a tailpipe on a hydrogen type engine and they're clapping at how wonderful it is that there's no emissions coming out of there, it's just water. Well, what that water is evidence that they just destroyed almost all the potential work that that hydrogen could have done. And what I mean by that is that the key to the Meyer process is to prevent the formation of the water molecule. Because if you have this water gas mixed with air and you ignite that in an engine, you get the detonation. And what happens is that this hydrogen will instantly combine with the oxygen, and then it will just shrink in volume and turn back into water. Well, while it shrinks in volume, you just negated all the expansive energy from that. And so you don't really get a net push down on the piston because it's that detonation just creates water.
So the nitrogen molecule sort of babysits the hydrogen molecule to keep it stable. Is that the idea?
Yeah, after the hydrogen is ignited, it will attract to the nitrogen. See, because the nitrogen makes up 78% of the atmospheric gases, and nitrogen is typically thought to have the strongest normal electron bond. Between two nitrogen atoms, there's three electrons, which is known as a triple electron bond, and is typically thought to take a lot of energy, heat, and pressure to be able to crack that nitrogen to get atomic nitrogen, which is a process, you know, the Haber-Bosch process they use to create like industrial ammonia. It's very energy intensive.
All right, so you've clarified that Stanley Meyer, he wasn't running his engine on water.
No.
I want to get back to the plasma ignition system. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, how are you creating this abnormally large and powerful spark, which is further, you know, detonating the fuel,
right,
in a more, you know, powerful way? I mean, how are you creating this large spark? I mean, what makes the plasma ignition system so unique?
Well, there's a massive increase in the power of the spark, but it also looks like there's an energy gain. Power and energy are very different, and just to orient everybody to what the difference is that with power, let's say you walk over to a window and you knock on it, and you knock on it again, and you knock on it again 10 times, you won't break the window. But let's say you take the energy that you dissipated in all 10 knocks and you put it into one knock, you're going to shatter the glass. And so basically in this capacitor that would normally be used like in a so-called capacitive discharge ignition system, that capacitor is discharging relatively slow into the ignition coil as the power source because it has all these resistances that it has to fight against. You can call it impedance, there's resistance. So it slows down the time that the capacitor discharges, which means you're taking the energy and you're dissipating that energy over a long period of time, so the power is very, very low. What I do is I can add one single passive electronic component, which is known as a diode, a high voltage diode. A diode is kind of like a one-way valve for electricity, is a simple way to look at it. And what I do is I trick the circuit and basically make the resistance in the entire circuit disappear, is what appears to be happening, so that when the capacitor discharges, it discharges in an abnormally short period of time. So you take all that energy and you compress it into one bang in a short period of time that's normally not supposed to happen. And that's why you see this little ball of sunshine at the spark plug for the exact same amount of energy.
So how do you get the capacitor to empty itself so quickly? And this would be, I guess, in contravention of Lenz's law or this back EMF, right? Where you have magnets involved, this magnetic field,
mm-hmm.
you have sort of this kind of an equal and opposite counter electromotive force.
Yeah, well, there's these governing forces in nature and on electronics, and you can kind of call it a governor, I guess, which is what resistance is, which is that electron drag. But what happens is I get the capacitor to jump over a gap in addition to the high voltage output. Now, normally when people see a spark, it takes a certain amount of voltage to be able to jump a gap. Typically in open air, it will take about, you know, 3,500 to 4,500 volts for the high voltage spark to jump across like a 1 millimeter gap, 35 to 4,000 volts. If I told somebody that I could take a 400 volt capacitor and jump over a 1 millimeter gap or a 2 millimeter gap or a 1 centimeter gap, they would say that would be impossible. So what I do is I trick the circuit so that the high voltage jumps across the gap first, just a normal high voltage spark. And when it jumps the gap, it actually creates a conductivity at that gap because the gap is so-called ionized. which means it's very positively charged. And if something is very positively charged, that means it's seeking something negatively charged to be able to balance itself and to bring it back to equilibrium. And so since it's such a strong vacuum for the electrons, it is pulling on the electron current coming from that capacitor across the entire circuit, which means when the gap is ionized by the high voltage, it becomes conductive so that the capacitor of only a couple hundred volts doesn't see a gap anymore. It almost sees just a straight circuit that it jumps across. And so you're mixing high voltage and low current with low voltage and high current over the same gap.
How are you overcoming the back EMF, though, this counter electromotive force? How are you overcoming Lenz's law?
Yeah, the back EMF would be more as the counter resistance in an electromagnetic coil. There is some of that. But as far as the gap itself is concerned, is that I'm creating a negative resistance effect. And what I mean by that is, let's say you have a little wind tunnel. And let's say you have, there's no wind going through it, but you take a paper airplane and you throw it at 1 mile per hour, it's going to encounter the air, which gives like a positive resistance to that airplane, and the airplane is just going to point in a different direction. It's just going to kind of, turn, and it's just going to, go down to the ground. Now, let's say you remove the resistance and you have a fan at the other end of the tunnel pulling at 1 mile per hour. It has a steady breeze at 1 mile per hour. So if you take that paper airplane and you throw it into the wind tunnel at 1 mile an hour, it's no longer hitting that resistance. The resistance is gone, and so it's just steadily moving from one end of the tunnel to the other at 1 mile per hour. But let's say we have a fan at the other end sucking the air out of that tunnel at 5 miles per hour, and let's say you take the paper airplane and you throw it in there at 1 mile per hour, it's going to speed up at a negative resistance towards 5 miles per hour as it's going through there. And so what happens is the high voltage on one side of the gap is able to suck on the current like a vacuum cleaner at a higher voltage than it's normally associated with, which means that current is actually accelerating towards that high voltage. And so no longer is the current pushing into a positive resistance. It's being sucked by that high voltage pulling on it at a negative resistance. And so the capacitor can discharge, but it doesn't see any resistance on the whole circuit.
Okay, and again, let me refer people to coasttocoastam.com, the homepage. Go to the carousel there and just wait for the slide, or you can advance the slides backwards, forwards, and look for the one that says Murakami Plasma Videos, and there they can see demonstrations of the plasma ignition system. Okay, so we have a sort of a basic understanding of how you're able to generate a more powerful explosive spark, which then is able to burn more fuel and generate more power. And with a bigger spark, then you're able to burn less fuel, which means it's a leaner fuel mixture, right?
Absolutely.
You're also drawing some of the hydrogen out of the you're disassociating the hydrogen and oxygen molecules out of the air. And that's further providing kind of as an incendiary device, if further explosive power for the gasoline fuel.
Correct.
Or whatever fuel you're using. So, I mean, how did you figure this out? You mentioned one little innocuous little piece of electronics, a diode. How did you know that if you included a diode in this circuit, you would be able to achieve all this, what amounts to a very disruptive piece of technology?
Around in the early 2000s, I don't know, it was maybe around 2001 or something, a good friend and partner of mine, Peter Lindemann, at that time, I didn't know him very well, he came out with a book called Free Energy Secrets of Cold Electricity, which was basically his thesis on how one particular holy grail free energy technology known as the Ed Gray motor operated. And he recommended a book called Secrets of Cold War Technology by Jerry Vassilatos, which that book was kind of used as a Rosetta Stone to kind of reverse engineer some of the concepts in the Gray motor. I went out to John Bedini's, and he recommended I get those books. And because Peter had pretty much kind of been right on about what John witnessed years ago, because John knew Ed Gray. Him and one of his partners, Ron Cole, went out, saw this Ed Gray motor, documented it, and drew the lab notes down on how it operated. And John Bedini released these his old notes from back in the 80s online.
And what was so special, very quickly, about the gray motor? What was it able to do?
The claim is that it was producing hundreds and hundreds of times more work than what was going into it, just operating on a couple of batteries.
Okay, so then from that, you gleaned this information that led to the development of the plasma ignition system.
Yeah, because there was one diagram in John Bedini's writings where there's like a big spark gap inside of this gray tube, and on one end of it, on the low voltage side, there was this diode that was facing in a different direction than what most people would think. A lot of people commented that it's facing in the wrong direction. Well, because I didn't really have an electronics engineering background, and I looked at it and understood the principle of what it was supposed to do, it always made complete sense to me. And so fast forwarding to about, I don't know, 2007 or so, some people were talking about these different ignition technologies online where the aim was to have a water-powered car. And I started to look at these and the diagrams where somebody had claimed that they were running a car on water, and I'm seeing this diode, and nobody was really connecting the dots. And as soon as I saw it, I realized that it's basically the circuit that I proposed is 100% mirror image of the Ed Gray circuit. It's just miniaturized. And so I was able to just pinpoint it right on the spot because of my understanding of how the diode operated in John Bedini's circuit of what he showed what Ed Gray was doing. So it always made sense to me, but it didn't make sense to people who had a more of an electronics engineering background.
Okay, so why then, we've sort of touched on this, but let's bring it all back home. Why is the plasma ignition system that you've helped develop, why is it so disruptive?
It's disruptive because it basically has a potential to greatly reduce the amount of fuel people are using in their cars.
By how much?
Let's see. 30 to 40% increase is easy. In some tests that a old dragster guy who was a master of V8 engines named Smokey Unick, he had tested this type of more antiquated version of this plasma ignition system years ago. And just for proving the concept, he had an air fuel ratio of 100 to 1 where the engine was just idling at 100 to 1. 14.7 parts air to one part fuel is considered the perfect mixture, and if you get leaner than that, the claim is that the engine's going to overheat, it's going to ping and everything else, cause damage, and that's a half-truth. That's only true if you're trying to ignite an ultra-lean mixture with a conventional spark, but all that changes when you start to ignite it with a plasma ignition because you're freeing up this hydrogen right on demand to be able to ignite a lean mixture. So Smokey Unick had it running at 100 to 1. I mean, that's many, many, many times more efficient, the thermal efficiency, than what's supposed to be believable, what's supposed to be possible.
And because it's burning so efficiently, you don't have the vapors, the noxious vapors, benzene and all of these other things that are added to gasoline coming out the tailpipe. So
emissions are greatly reduced. Carbon buildup is greatly reduced. A lot of maintenance in the engine is directly related to the carbon buildup because the efficiency is so bad. It feeds the industry. A typical car lot.
So there goes in the built-in obsolescence.
No, absolutely. Yeah, the dirtier the engine runs, the more profitable it is, the more often you have to change your oil. If you never have carbon buildup, look how long the oil is going to last. I know people who own dealerships, and for the most part, the dealership itself, when they do repairs on an automobile, that basically covers the cost to run the operation, and the profits come from selling the cars. And so if you eliminate a lot of the maintenance that the dealerships have to do, then they're not going to be making profit on the cars. It won't even be able to sustain itself. So they have to have something where there is the integrated obsolescence, where the dirtier the engine, the more profitable it's going to be.
Aaron Murakami, let me pull a Ned Beatty on you from Network. You are messing with the primal order of nature, and you will repent, or something like that. Anyway, it's true, though. I mean, that's what you're up against. You are meddling with the primal order. You have increased fuel efficiency 30-40%. That's a conservative estimate. You have... Can we say eradicated most of the emissions, or you've greatly reduced the emissions?
Yeah, greatly reduced emissions, increased power, and increased mileage, as long as you can get around the computer sabotage in the electronic cars. If you have a carburetor car, it's easier to manage because you can lean it out as much as you want.
Well, that was my next question. Have you installed the plasma ignition system? I think you tried to show me on your car, but you couldn't circumvent the computer. So you can't make the mixture lean enough for it to be of any use.
Yeah, I put it on my Subaru, which has an EJ 25 engine, which is basically a 2.5-liter opposed piston boxer engine. And I managed to, and the reason I put it on that car is because it has a ignition system known as a wasted spark ignition, where half of the cylinders are high voltage positive, half of them are high voltage negative. Everybody was saying it was impossible to put the plasma ignition on there because of the way the diode has to be facing for the electricity to move in whatever direction. And the reason I put it on my car was not necessarily because I was interested in putting it on my car, but just to prove that you can put it on a wasted spark ignition system, and I solved that problem. My primary intent is to be able to use the plasma ignition on a gas generator set for home power production.
Yes, you have a jet engine out in the backyard there, you showed me. You and your colleague Jeff Moe fired that up for us.
Correct.
And we're coming up on a break, and we'll pick this up on the other side. But you placed this plasma ignition system on the jet engine, which is running on propane. I also believe you have a generator that you used during a power outage in Spokane, and you had the plasma ignition system on that. Well, let's start with the generator.
Okay.
When you put it on there, what happened?
When I put it on there, to be honest with you, I didn't have a reduction in fuel because the carburetor on there has a fixed jet. So no matter how efficient you run it, as long as that air is moving over that Venturi, it's going to pump the same amount of fuel. However, when I had appliances hooked to it, and every time the refrigerator would hook up or whatever, at first I was running it with a regular magneto ignition system on the generator, and it kept bogging out and stalling out, and I had to go out every 30 minutes or something like that and restart the generator. And I looked at the plasma ignition sitting on top, realizing I wasn't even using it. I had
all right, let me jump in there, Aaron. I'm sorry for the interruption. We'll pick up this discussion on the other side. We'll head into the break with the Chambers Brothers, and this time has come today. Back with more of my conversation with Aaron Murakami, the plasma ignition system, right here on Coast to Coast AM.